We're talking about nuclear power here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Americans are split down the middle on whether nuclear power is the path forward for making electricity in the U.S. According to the recent Gallup Environment poll that was conducted last month, roughly equal percentages of Americans say nuclear plants are safe as they are not safe. And this is the first time in Gallup's 10-year trend on this question that a plurality of Americans have considered nuclear power unsafe. So what questions do you have about nuclear power? Do you want to know more about how it works? What do you wonder about how we manage nuclear waste? We're at 800-642-1234. Paul Wilson is a nuclear engineering professor at UW-Madison. He chairs the Energy Analysis and Policy Graduate Certificate Program, and he serves on the board of directors for the American Nuclear Society. Paul, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, let's just take a moment to remember that it is the 40th anniversary just passed of the Three Mile Island nuclear reactor meltdown, and accidents like this one, like Chernobyl, they're perhaps why some people are hesitant about the use of nuclear power. Can you talk about the dangers of this type of energy? What are the risks?
So it's unfortunate that these incidents cloud people's understanding of nuclear energy. It's certainly true that at the time when Three Mile Island happened, there was a lot of history of lack of transparency and a lot of confusion about what was happening. But ultimately, the accident at Three Mile Island, while it was a big financial accident for the company, it didn't have a substantial consequence to the public other than the panic that it caused when it happened. And so while there are risks from operating nuclear power plants, the risk is largely to contamination of the land. And what we've seen over the last few situations like Chernobyl and Fukushima is that the immediate public health impact is actually quite small. And then the real impact that we have to deal with as a community is the impact to large amounts of land that sometimes become uninhabitable for a period of time.
Yeah, and while I don't remember too much about Three Mile Island, I really, really remember Chernobyl. That sticks out to me. What do we know about what happens after these types of disasters and how we respond to them and what we think about nuclear energy?
So there's a growing awareness that the way that we choose to set up our evacuation plans is maybe not the best way to manage these situations. We saw in Fukushima in particular that there was a lot of people evacuated that may have been safer if they'd stayed in place. And so one of the things that we are looking at as a community is how do we better manage that? I think if you go all the way back to Three Mile Island, I don't remember it much myself either. But one of the big things we learned there was it's really important to have a carefully coordinated and well-managed emergency response plan. In fact, this is a lesson from Three Mile Island that has been now copied into many other industries, chemical industries, oil refineries, things like that.
Nuclear waste can remain radioactive for generations. Can you explain how the uranium used to generate nuclear power becomes waste?
So for nuclear reactors in the United States today, we mine uranium from the earth, usually in other countries, and we import it for the most part. We process it and turn it into fuel for reactors, and then it spends about 4.5 years in a reactor. In that time, most of the uranium that goes into the reactor actually comes out as uranium again, and about 5% of it, 1/20th of it, is now radioactive material that needs to be managed carefully. It's all mixed in. It's a solid material, so it's not like we can just tap off that 5% and do something with it. And so the fission process causes this waste to arise. And now we have used nuclear fuel assemblies that then we put in large, basically swimming pools for 5 or 10 years to let it cool down. And after that time, we can take it out and put it in above-ground canisters and store it for decades at that point, and until we come up with a long-term policy solution.
So with the geological repository option for managing waste, it remains underground for generations. How do we know it will stay safe there?
So that's it's a long analysis, many decades of analysis in a site like Yucca Mountain, for example. So in 1987, the United States, as a matter of policy, chose Yucca Mountain in Nevada as the place to store used nuclear fuel, or the first place to store used nuclear fuel. And that set off a couple of decades of geologic study and then analysis. And the key part of that analysis is that the scientists and engineers use the information they know about the site to investigate hundreds of thousands of different possible futures. and examine what is the risk of radiation release to the public in each of those different possible futures. Those futures include relatively modest variations about the climate and the weather over that time, and they may include a few very dramatic variations, like volcanoes erupting through the middle of the repository or future civilizations digging and mining into the repository.
Perhaps climate change.
Yeah, climate change is certainly a factor in some of their analysis.
Talking with Paul Wilson, he is a nuclear engineering professor at UW-Madison. You can join in with your questions. What questions do you have about nuclear power? Do you want to know more about how it works? What do you wonder about how we manage the waste? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring in Chris now, joining us from Port Wing. Hi, Chris.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for this timely show. I just want to point a few things out. First of all, nuclear power is unaffordable. If we look at the levelized cost analyzed in 2017 by the Lazard Group, which does the levelized cost of energy analysis, wind and solar cost per megawatt hour is $48 and $49.9 per megawatt hour. Nuclear is 92.6, almost double the cost. It is totally uninsurable. Today, we, the U.S. taxpayers, insure the entire nuclear industry, except for a small pittance, under the Price-Anderson Act. If nuclear power was forced to pay for its hazards and pay for its insurance, it would cost significantly more, but it's still not affordable now.
Chris, let's pause right there to look at the expense of nuclear.
Certainly, nuclear energy is expensive compared to some sources. I think if you compare it to the renewable sources that we just heard about, they're rapidly coming down in price, and they're an important part of our energy future. A lot of studies are looking at long-term and deep decarbonization of our energy system. And if you're looking at really removing carbon from our electricity system, high penetrations of wind and solar actually start to reduce their affordability as well. And we had a visitor on campus last week who really had some interesting work that he'd done looking at this. And so you need to have a balanced system. You need to have to use his metaphor, a full team. You can't just have one position on your team and try and stock your team with one position. You need to have all different kinds of sources. And so looking in the future, even at the current prices of nuclear energy, they look like they still result in an affordable energy system in the future if you need to remove carbon.
But the infrastructure itself may be impeding getting these plants online in the first place or even remaining in operation. Is that impeding nuclear power?
So right now, the current fleet of reactors is challenged by the current economic structure of our energy markets. In some places in the country, we see very cheap natural gas is really driving down the ability of nuclear energy in particular, but all energy sources to be competitive.
We're learning about the future of nuclear energy, where research stands on advanced technology, how Wisconsin fits into this energy source, into this picture. UW-Madison nuclear engineering professor Paul Wilson stays with us. He's on the board of the American Nuclear Society. Gathering your questions about reactors, they're welcome at 800-642-1234. Do you want to know more about how nuclear power works? What do you wonder about how we manage nuclear waste? Do you remember Three Mile Island or perhaps the Chernobyl disaster in 86? Do you think we've come a long way since then, or are those kinds of accidents still worrisome to you? Call in. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation in just a minute right here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the future of nuclear energy, the challenges, the opportunities. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The industry has struggled with justifying the cost of building new reactors, and plants still in operation face tough competition right now in electricity markets from less expensive forms of generation. We saw last week a group of 15 senators reintroduced a bill to instate the Nuclear Energy Leadership Act, which would offer incentives for advanced nuclear energy. What policies should our government consider when it comes to energy generation and storage? Do you work at Wisconsin's nuclear plant? Tell us your experience at 800-642-1234. Paul Wilson is our guide. He's a nuclear engineering professor at UW-Madison. Let's go back to the phones now with Frank joining us from Green Bay. Good morning, Frank.
Morning.
What's on your mind?
Oh, I appreciate you guys bringing this conversation forward. I think it's going to be an important part in the short term of reducing carbon emissions and helping the grid be stable. One key point that I thought I would point out is you guys have been using the term generations for a while. I think it's important to correct that. The waste is going to last for millennia. It's going to last far more than generations. So my question for the guest is there has to be some kind of associated dollar amount for the nuclear waste that we have currently. Is there a dollar amount annually for the created nuclear waste in the projections if we were to amp this up? And then also with Yucca Mountain, I don't believe that ever went through. That was just a plan, right? I mean, what is our current status of the nuclear waste, and what are we actually trying to do,
Frank,
with that nuclear waste for the 10,000 years?
Yeah, Frank, thanks for those questions. Paul, can you tackle that?
Sure. So 2 points there. I think in terms of the cost, important step forward, important leadership example in nuclear energy is that in 1982, we established the nuclear waste fee. And for every single unit of energy produced at nuclear power plants since then, we have been contributing to a fund that's held by the U.S. government to pay for the ultimate disposal of spent nuclear fuel. So I like to compare it to a carbon tax. I mean, basically, this is nuclear energy's carbon tax, where we now allow other kinds of generation sources to put their waste into the atmosphere at no fee. Nuclear energy has been putting money down and saving money to manage its waste issues. On the topic of Yucca Mountain, so Yucca Mountain is the law of the land. It is where the current policy says we shall use nuclear fuel. A license application was submitted to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission in 2008. That license application has been evaluated by the staff. Most assessments seem like it's probably a viable license design, but a lack of funding by Congress in annual appropriations for about the last 10 years has prevented the license application from moving forward.
Thanks, Frank. Let's go to Kristen now in La Crosse. Kristen, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's on your mind?
So I'm actually wondering, your guest made a statement earlier about the, how the land might be affected for a little while and it wouldn't be really and a long-term effect to human health. But I guess I'm wondering what the length of time that land would be affected, because it's not a small thing, kind of what your most recent guest commented on. It's not a short term that it would be unlivable. So I guess I'm wondering what your guest thoughts are on that.
I mentioned that to sort of contrast, I think, the sort of immediate fear that people have about nuclear reactors versus this sort of long-term impact. It's certainly an important factor, and I think that, and I also brought it up because I think it's where we as a nuclear community need to really turn our attention. For a lot of that land can be remediated fairly rapidly. Usually a topsoil layer that needs to be cleaned off and cleared off. But I think there's also opportunities to do a lot of research and understand, you know, exactly how much of that land needs to be held out and for how long. So I think that when, you know, looking at the history we've had of accidents in nuclear energy, I think that we as a nuclear energy community really need to turn to this question of how land gets affected by accidents in the nuclear industry, because I think that the evidence is that large numbers of people don't get immediately harmed, but instead it's this long-term disruption, and this is a place where we need to make it better.
Well, let's look at politics for a moment. Democrats in the House are working on what they call this Green New Deal to address climate change, and the plan would eliminate America's dependence on fossil fuels. The deal doesn't exclude nuclear power from the solution, but it also doesn't recommend it. perhaps, you know, making the case for why nuclear energy should be a facet of that plan. What are you thinking there?
Yeah, so the Green New Deal is a really exciting opportunity, I think, for the nation to turn towards a real low-carbon solution. I see a lot of young nuclear engineers in particular are really excited about trying to build coalitions within that organization and within that group to develop a place for nuclear energy to be part of the solution. If you look at the different kinds of energy supply we have for electricity, they have different characteristics. And solar and wind are excellent for reducing our reliance on fuels. We may call them fuel savers. Every time the wind is blowing and the sun is shining, we should take full advantage of those as much as we can. But as you look to try and have a balanced and effective electricity system, you need other sorts of supplies. You need firm supplies that will be around whenever you need them and you can dispatch them on demand. And then you need other kinds that will ramp up in between and help you bridge between those firm and those variable sources. And the most efficient and economic energy systems of the future will need a balance of those things. And nuclear plays a role in that firm, low-carbon area.
Well, let's pretend the country would support a widespread nuclear build-out to transfer some of our energy dependence away from fossil fuels to nuclear. What would that take to happen to make that a reality?
I mean the number one thing, I suppose, that many of us have been asking for a long time is a real sense of a national energy policy where there is a committed direction in one way. Our energy system in the United States has long been, with deregulation, has been left to individual utilities and individual regions to decide what's right for them. And so I think something like a Green New Deal would establish a real sense of direction. And then with that, it would allow companies to flourish and come up with lots of new ideas. We can go forward with nuclear energy with existing technology. It's not clear that that's going to be the best path forward. The nuclear energy world has probably never had as much innovation, as much excitement around new ideas, different reactor concepts, particularly going to smaller reactors that can be built in a factory and shipped to site rather than large, big civil construction projects.
Yeah, and so there's this advanced technology going on in the background here as we even think about reactors. Do we have enough reactors right now in the country to even be able to elevate nuclear power?
So right now, the United States has nearly 100 reactors. We're the biggest user of nuclear energy in the world. And so if we can maintain all those reactors through their existing lifetime and maybe extend the lives of some of those reactors when it's safe to do so, then that will help us bridge into the next round of technology. The small modular reactors that are coming online now, if we can start to build those in the next 5 or 10 years and demonstrate that that's a viable path forward, it will make it easier for companies to invest when you know, one of the big challenges of nuclear energy is how expensive they are to build in the first place. And as you make the reactors bigger, over time, there was an economy of scale of having really big reactors. Now the economy of scale would be having many, many smaller reactors. It would allow us to take advantage of a lot of the innovation cycles that happen in other technologies that haven't been happening in nuclear energy.
So is it possible then to find out a balance here? What is the balance between nuclear, geothermal, fossil fuels? It sounds like you need to have a lot of different combinations here to make electricity work in the U.S.
Right. There's a diverse portfolio is really the best path forward. One of the big factors is really how hard we're going to push towards decarbonization. If we need to go to very low carbon levels, then that's going to narrow the set of choices down. As I said, the evidence is we need some sort of firm, low-carbon sources. Nuclear energy is one of them. Geothermal would be another. Carbon sequestration out of fossil fuel plants would be another. Some of those are available now. Some of those are geographically limited, and some of those are research projects for the future. But some combination of those things is probably necessary to have an efficient electricity system.
Taking a look at this Gallup poll last month, it asked the country about nuclear power. 49% of Americans favor the use of nuclear energy. 49% oppose it. Why do you think nuclear power is a polarizing topic?
I think that there's many reasons for that. I think at the core is the relationship people have with radiation. And that comes historically from duck and cover of the Cold War and the connection historically and in many people's minds continuing between the fear of radiation from nuclear weapons and the fear of radiation from nuclear reactors. And this unknown kind of nature of it. It's something that we don't naturally sense as humans. So we don't have an evolutionary time scale of being comfortable with this kind of sense.
As we wrap up, you're a nuclear engineer. You work with students all day long as they plot out their careers. Do you see excitement in them for a future in nuclear energy?
Yeah, I'm leaving today to go to the American Nuclear Society's National Student Conference, where there'll be a few hundred very excited nuclear engineers. In the last 10 or 15 years, it's been a real clear shift where the majority of the students that we engage with are people who are really concerned about the environment, concerned about climate, and they see nuclear energy as the solution to a real grand challenge problem. And that's the excitement that drives them to pursue their careers.
Paul, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Paul Wilson is a nuclear engineering professor at UW-Madison, chairs the Energy Analysis and Policy Graduate Certificate Program, and he's on the board of directors for the American Nuclear Society. Coming up next, it's news, then we'll look at the growing impact that climate change is having on the Great Lakes. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. We're looking at climate change in the Great Lakes here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Rising temperatures could lower water levels in the Great Lakes. It could intensify harmful algae blooms, threaten fish and wildlife. And this new study by scientists in the Midwest, it amassed peer-reviewed research and drew a number of conclusions, including that the Great Lakes region is warming faster than the rest of the continental U.S. It's getting wetter at a much faster rate than the rest of the country. Do you live on or near one of the Great Lakes? What changes have you seen over the years? What do you keep track of? How do you think climate change is having an impact on the landscape around you? You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Dan Vimond is a UW-Madison professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences, and he directs the Center for Climatic Research, studying how our physical climate system works, as well as the global and regional impacts of climate change. And he contributed to the Environmental Law and Policy Center's report on how climate change is affecting the Great Lakes. Dan, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So you were part of this report from the Environmental Law and Policy Center. What was the intent behind this research?
There are two parts to the report. There's a scientific assessment of what we know about climate change and its impacts in the Great Lakes, and then that's the part that I contributed to. And there's a number of other scientists on there. That was led by Don Weibels at Illinois. And then there's a second part to the report, which includes a bunch of policy recommendations, and that came from the Environmental Law Policy Center. And so the intent was to try and assess what we know about climate change, what is already happening in the Great Lakes, and what we might expect. And that goes beyond just understanding changes in temperature and precipitation, but also starting to look at impacts that affect us directly.
And it's really easy to take the Great Lakes for granted. They've been there a heck of a long time, and we might just assume that they'll continue to be there without paying a lot of attention to the finer details and how the health of their health. Can you tell us about the impact that these lakes have on our lives and on our climate?
The Great Lakes, I see them as kind of a national icon. I mean, they're one of the most recognizable geographical features in our entire country. And I imagine that anybody listening has their own personal experience with the Great Lakes and their own reason why they kind of relate to these Great Lakes. Beyond that, there's more than 34 million people who live in the Great Lakes Basin. There's major urban areas that are right on the Great Lakes, and they are responsible for several million dollars, or I'm sorry, billions of dollars worth of economic impact, but really I see them as kind of a national icon. You know, they're like the California coast or the Rocky Mountains. They're something that are just part of our country and are the fabric of our country.
And this report, it doesn't mince words. It says right out of the gate, climate change is causing significant and far-reaching impacts on the Great Lakes and the Great Lakes region. And we're going to get to the specifics, but can you paint us a picture of what this impact is actually looking like?
Some of the changes we've already seen, we know that that our temperatures have warmed by about 1.6 degrees Fahrenheit, or about a degree Celsius thereabouts, over the last several decades. And that's likely to continue with an additional 2 to 7 degrees of warming by mid-century. We've been getting wetter, especially this last decade in Wisconsin. Has been kind of an anomaly. We also see changes in kind of extreme rainfall events. So we've seen increases in the frequency of very large rainfall events, and that's likely to continue too. That's all very consistent with climate change projections.
And we thought Lake Superior was kind of avoiding these impacts of climate change for a long time, kind of doing its own thing and able to, you know, not kind of resist these changes. But even Lake Superior is very much impacted by climate change.
Yeah, my understanding is that it's changing quite rapidly at Lake Superior, maybe even more so than some of the other lakes.
So this report, it amassed peer-reviewed research on the Great Lakes, developed conclusions that we're talking about. How does taking a whole bunch of research from all these different places and bringing it together, how does that expose new things?
That's a good question. There's two kind of messages that I take there and what take from that this report. One is actually not a new message, and I think oftentimes we look for the new messages and look for how things change our understanding. In this case, saying the same thing again is really important, and that is that we know that climate is changing in the Great Lakes. We've known this for a long time. We know that the warming is likely to be, you know, an additional 2 to 7 degrees in the next 2 to 7 degrees Fahrenheit in the next, say, 30 years or so. And this is not new. And so that's actually an important statement that that when we assess the current state of the science and we look back, a lot of work has continued to be done on this, but the message really hasn't changed in that. And so what that means is that we can be and we should be trying to adapt to these expected changes. We should also be trying to think about ways to contribute to reducing the expected amount of climate change. What I think is interesting from this report, and what's really kind of an important change in our field, is the way we're putting this information together and trying to understand impacts that are beyond just the temperature and precipitation changes. So this report deals with Great Lakes ecosystems, water quality, agriculture, urban issues, fisheries and wildlife, changes to shipping, changes to recreation. And what I find interesting is that it kind of takes a holistic approach and says, well, what are the various things that impact processes in the Great Lakes, that say physical processes, and how do those then translate to some of these changes?
Talking with Dan Bimont, he is a professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW-Madison. We're talking about the impact of climate change on the Great Lakes. Gathering your questions along the way at 800-642-1234. What actions would you like to see on behalf of lawmakers on this issue, climate change on the Great Lakes? Have you taken steps in your own life to lower your impact? What questions do you have about the climate research happening here in Wisconsin? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Well, let's look a little bit more closely at one of these big takeaways, that the region is warming faster than the rest of the continental U.S. How much faster are we talking about, and why is that happening?
That's a good question. I'm not sure that we know necessarily why why it's warming a little faster than the rest of the U.S. So the U.S. as a whole has warmed by about 1.2 degrees Fahrenheit, and here in the Great Lakes we've warmed by about 1.6. One of the reasons why that may be occurring is northern regions tend to warm a little more than southern regions, just because of various physical processes in the climate system, like snow cover, for example. When you have a lot of snow cover in wintertime, and especially in the shoulder seasons, that snow reflects the sun's radiation, and so it can keep things colder. When you get rid of, when you warm, then you get rid of some of that snow, and then there's that reflective property isn't there anymore. And so that's what we call a snow and ice feedback, and so that may be contributing to some of the warming. Certainly, one thing we've observed in especially in Wisconsin, is that wintertime has warmed a lot more than summertime. The bulk of the warming that we've seen in Wisconsin is in wintertime, and that's all consistent with that kind of a climate change effect. That may be one of the reasons why the Great Lakes as a whole is warming more than the country as a whole.
And you're seeing less ice on the Great Lakes, is that right?
Absolutely. There's a reduction in ice cover in the Great Lakes, and locally in Madison, we're definitely seeing that. We have one of the longest time series of ice cover in the world here on Lake Mendota. I think it goes back to the 1860s, and we see a large downward trend in the amount of ice and the duration of ice cover. And that there are impacts there on recreation and in northern for Lake Superior that can be impacts on shipping and transportation.
So when you look at those impacts, higher temperatures, more rainfall, and less ice pack, what is the impact then on your, perhaps your water quality, your impact on local residents? Where do you see the impacts?
That's one of the things I think is really interesting about this report, is that it looks at kind of a holistic approach to the specific impacts. And so I'll give one example there. We know that the climate's warming in the Great Lakes, and that leads to warmer water temperatures in the Great Lakes, not surprisingly. We also know that precipitation is increasing, and especially these extreme precipitation events. And so combined, the combined effect of these two is that large precipitation events will likely lead to more agricultural runoff, or runoff in urban areas as well. And that can lead to increased nutrient flow into the lakes, which can develop harmful algal blooms, which have impacts on water quality, impacts on ecosystems, and potentially impacts on human health as well. And so that's it's a good example of something kind of coming from this report. It's a good example of how we can take a variety of different changes, look at how the Great Lakes in particular respond to those changes, and then relate that to something that is important for just all of us living in the Great Lakes region.
So I hear you saying it's moving through the food chain, moving through the ecosystems, and really penetrating one after another in these areas.
Yeah, it's taking a kind of a systems approach and thinking about how a particular stressor to this system or a particular impact to the system can propagate through to something that affects us directly.
We're talking about the impact of climate change on the Great Lakes as a new study comes out. Dan Vimont is our guide. He is a professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW-Madison, contributed to the Environmental Law and Policy Center's report on how climate change is affecting the Great Lakes. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. When you think about the future of the Great Lakes, what do you worry about? What changes have you seen in your time on or near the water? Call in. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. A new study finds climate change in the Great Lakes region is happening faster than the rest of the U.S. We're talking about it here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Scientists around the Great Lakes amassed peer-reviewed research to highlight the magnitude of the current changes and what's to come. Among the big takeaways is that summer water temperatures in the lakes have increased over the past six decades. Ice cover dropped dramatically. Do you live on the Great Lakes? What environmental changes have you noticed? What actions would you like to see on behalf of lawmakers on this issue? And have you taken steps in your own personal life to lower your impact? There's a line for you at 800-642-1234. Dan Vimont stays with us. He's a professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences here at UW-Madison. Let's go to the phones now with Stephen joining us from Oshkosh. Hi, Stephen.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Hello. Okay, yeah. So my question is, given that high consumption lifestyles are they're really entrenched in both Western and global cultures, even growing globally, and you know, people are just really slow to change. I guess what hope really do we have of doing any more than just kind of slowing down the rate at which the climate is warming?
That's a good question, Stephen. That's a good question. There's a couple of things that when we talk about doing something about climate change, there's sort of two approaches that we can adapt. One is to try and slow the amount of climate change that's coming and eventually come to stop the rate of change. And then the other one is to do something about, given that we know that a certain amount of climate change is inevitable, we can prepare for those kinds of changes. And so both of those activities are pretty important. In terms of what we can do on a global scale and what we can do to try and slow down climate change, I think there is some good news on the horizon here. There is a large shift towards I think businesses are recognizing the economic opportunities available for renewable energy. I think we just heard I think the previous half hour was all in nuclear energy.
Mm-hmm.
There is a growing sort of understanding of a need to shift types of energy production. But you bring up a point, and that is that there is an inevitability about some of this. There's no changing the fact that in 2015, we passed 400 parts per million of carbon dioxide for the first time in the history of humans on the planet. And no one on the planet will ever see carbon dioxide concentration below 400 parts per million again. So there is an inevitability that we need to be preparing for. The good news is that, as this report shows as well, we know what those changes are likely to be, and we can start taking action already. And that's happening all over our state. I work with the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts. We work with the Wisconsin DNR, state agencies, DHS, individuals and groups all around the state who want climate information and so they can prepare for climate change. And so there's that second side of it, that adapting to what we know is coming is really important, and there's a lot of activity in that area.
Stephen, thanks so much for the call. Dan, looking at infrastructure, one of the recommendations calls for designing, developing, and installing green infrastructure to adapt to climate change and protect shorelines and wildlife. What would that look like?
That's a good question. I think some of the green infrastructure people have talked about is trying to increase permeable surfaces to allow more infiltration rather than direct runoff. And you know, when we get these huge events, I'm not sure that green infrastructure is gonna be the total answer, but it is a way of developing a more sustainable urban landscape, and for reducing the amount of warming, reducing things like urban heat island effects, and also for enhancing kind of infiltration of water rather than just having that water run directly into the lakes. So it's, that's one good option. Another thing that we need to be kind of thinking about are our systems that we have in place and the design of systems around a constantly changing background state. And so thinking about changing building codes or thinking about building around expected climatic change. And that's something that a lot of people are thinking about as well.
President Trump spoke about Great Lakes restoration last week at a rally in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And let's hear a bit.
I'm going to get, in honor of my friends, full funding of $300 million for the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative.
So prior to that, the president calling for this $300 million, he had called for spending $30 million, a 90% cut. One of the report's recommendations was to restore the funding for the successful Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. What's your response to the president's commitment there?
I'm glad he's reversed his original decision.
full stop, period. Is that it? Can we hear any more?
The Great Lakes Restoration Initiative is very important, and there's a Great Lakes Compact. There's a lot of people trying to develop our understanding and develop political agreements around the Great Lakes, both between states and with Canada as well. These are really important. One of the messages that comes out of climate change, and which I think is actually kind of a silver lining, if you can say this, is that in order to do something to adapt and to prepare ourselves for climate change, we really need to be communicating with each other as a society. And, you know, if climate change is going to cause us to do that, then I'm going to call that a little bit of a silver lining, because it seems to me that we need more of that in our culture right now.
So there's lots of proposals in this report. There are policy recommendations. But for the average person here, what can you do on the individual level to make a difference when you're looking at climate change?
Think about energy efficiency. There's the, you know, you can contribute your own. Think about the ways that you contribute to producing greenhouse gases and so forth. Things like switching to renewable energies. I know NGE has a plan for that, which we take advantage of. Look at energy and efficiency options. Think about these one-time things that you can do. For example, if you're buying a new house or if you have to move for some reason, think if you can move somewhere that you're not going to have to drive a long distance. And all these, you know, all of these are personal choices as well, and we need to balance these against our own senses of what we care about. The other thing, I guess, that's really important here is have the conversation. Have conversations with your neighbors. Think about what it means for you. Think about what it means for other people, and talk with other people about what it means to them. Climate change is going to affect every one of us in a different way. And it's an opportunity for us to converse with each other, get to know each other better, identify where our value systems are, and have that national conversation that needs to be happening to bring this to more of the forefront in issues nationally.
The takeaway for me from this study was that scientists know a whole lot about what impacts the Great Lakes, and that it's very clear to scientists here in the Midwest what is impacting the Great Lakes. Do you see research now moving in perhaps a different direction that is more of, now what can we do to help the Great Lakes, or where is research at?
That's a really astute sort of observation of this. We do have a lot of knowledge. I think in the last, say, decade or so, we've moved from just looking at changes in the physical climate system to understanding what those changes mean for specific impacts. And I want to emphasize, when we move from just talking about, say, temperature and precipitation to talking about what it means for someone, that process really requires a conversation. So as a climate scientist, I often say that I'm individually the wrong person to be telling anyone about what they should be doing about climate change, because I don't know what's important to people. And so that's why we set up the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impact. And you see some of this in this report as well, where when given the opportunity to have a conversation with people, I can learn about what's important. I can identify what are the important research topics, and together we can move forward on that.
Dan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
Dan Vimont, Professor of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison, Director of the Center for Climatic Research, contributed to a report from the Environmental Law and Policy Center. Just ahead, we see the world of organ transplants and a life of giving procedures. This is the Ideas Network.